Has your child started using phrases like this?
Hey, Mom, I'm going out with my Nancy on my knee. Yo-ho!
Or this.
Here's a pretty kettle of fish, kettle of fish, kettle of fish. Here's a pretty kettle of fish.
If annoying, antiquated language is creeping into your child's speech...
The deuce it is!
And you're finding strange costumes in her closet.
Mom, that's for when I play Yum Yum.
Your child may be one of millions, well, thousands, well, definitely dozens, of young Americans who are experimenting with light opera. Or it could be bath salts. It totally could be bath salts. And parents are usually the last to see it.
No, my daughter isn't getting all mixed up with Gilbert and Sullivan. She gets good grades, and she's into Norwegian death metal.
What seems like a youthful spree can turn into a lifetime of debilitating addiction.
I can quit Gilbert and Sullivan anytime I want to. Hey, I'm up for the Sergeant of Police in Penzance at the Albuquerque Light Opera.
Of course you are. Listen to this show, and if you recognize anybody you know from your life, let them know that you care. It's never too late to get help or join the 21st century. Please visit your local Light Opera Crisis Center today. And now, the star of Incontinent Monkeys of the Light Brigade, Colin McEnroe.
Incontinent Monkeys of the Light Brigade is the least produced of all Gilbert and Sullivan operas. And I don't understand why either, although there are some obvious animal training expenses. All right, so we want to tell you a little bit about Gilbert and Sullivan today. And I mean, some of you already know a lot about Gilbert and Sullivan. But one of the things that I discovered even getting ready for this show was that even sort of the staff of the show, everybody, all the producers and everything, would occasionally use the phrase, because I don't know anything about this. And I think, you know, maybe you saw it a little bit in Chariots of Fire, or maybe you've, you know, heard Todd Rundgren's version of one of the songs. But for a lot of people, this is kind of an impenetrable world. It's something that a lot of people derive incredible delight and joy from. And then for a lot of other people, it just seems very inscrutable. So we're going to try to pierce that curtain of inscrutability and also talk about some, you know, some go a little bit deeper into Gilbert and Sullivan as well. And we have a terrific group of guests here to help you do this. John Dreslin is music director of the Connecticut Gilbert and Sullivan Society. They are staging Yeoman of the Guard, October 19th and 20th in Deep River. For more information, as we will say several times today, ctgns.org. Bob Cummings is the artistic director and founder of the Connecticut Gilbert and Sullivan Society. Gerald Moschel is a professor of music at Trinity College. And Richard Vaughn is with the Simsbury Light Opera Company, which I believe is sometimes known as Sloco. Sloco?
Is that right? It is known as Sloco.
Sloco. Okay, so John Dreslin, I'm going to start with you. I mean, you probably run into this from time to time, people who say, I just don't get it. I don't get what that's all about. I've never been to one. I kind of have the vaguest idea that there's this modern major general song or something like it, but I don't get it. What is it? What's it all about? How would you, by way of inveigling someone to come to the Connecticut Gilbert and Sullivan Society, what would you tell them?
Well, I'd say that this is the ancestor to the modern musical theater that a lot of people are familiar with. Librettos, the writing is very high quality. The music is also of high quality, but the magical thing about it is how this the wonderful words and music come together in just almost perfect form. And I think everybody should certainly expose themselves at least once to a good Gilbert and Sullivan production and see if they don't get hooked like we are.
and hooked you are. Well, you know, since he brings that up, I was going to talk about this a little bit later in the show. And by the way, if you have something you want to chime in with or a question you want to ask, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us. You may tweet us. That sounds Gilbertian. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. Jerry Moschel, you know, he just said this is the ancestor of the American musical. Set the stage for us a little bit. Anyway, put Gilbert and Sullivan in context. This is all being produced more or less in the Victorian era before there's an American musical theater, right?
Correct. It's being produced in the late 1800s. And to me, it's greatly of interest that the only shows, musical theater type shows, before Oklahoma, 1943, that are revived today with any regularity in their original form are the Gilbert and Sullivan shows. The earlier shows, the Gershwin shows, are never revived with any regularity in their original form. Maybe that leaves out Porgy and Bess, but that's an opera after all.
Showboat?
Showboat is fooled around with every time, but that's the closest. Showboat, 1927, and I think the fact that Rodgers and Hammerstein start in 1943, and Hammerstein is the librettist for Showboat, is of some consequence in this. But other than that, only the Gilbert and Sullivan shows are revived in their original forms.
And it does seem as though come a little closer to the mic when you when you're talking to us. But it seems fair to say, even sort of, and I know you're a great student of the American musical theater. Sondheim, I think, has specifically said that on A Little Night Music, he was kind of riffing on Gilbert and Sullivan. Hart, Larry Hart, is a big Gilbert and Sullivan fan. I'm not sure about Ira Gershwin, but it would sort of make sense that he was.
Ira Gershwin was a very big Gilbert and Sullivan fan.
So basically the people we think of as kind of the canon for the American musical theater, the people who really are sort of the bedrock people. There's no question that's true, that what John Dreslin is saying is true, that this is in a lot of ways the ancestor. True?
Absolutely.
All right.
And they all acknowledge it. Mr. Sondheim doesn't seem to admire the pieces as much as most other composers and lyricists of his ilk, but nevertheless, it's indubitably true.
Well, as we now know, Sondheim doesn't seem to admire anything all that much. I mean, he basically has to complain about everything. You guys can tell me a little bit more about just what the gateway was for you. I mean, Richard Vaughan, how did you become a Gilbert and Sullivan freak, if that's not the wrong word?
Freak is probably true, but not necessarily just Gilbert and Sullivan. I started singing with the Simsbury Light Opera Company in 1992, although I was actually brought up in the UK and educated there. I didn't sing any Gilbert and Sullivan until I came here. What attracted me to it? It was an opportunity to prove that I could sing and walk at the same time, because all I'd done before was sing and sit or sing and stand. So that's what brought me to Gilbert and Sullivan, that and the opportunity to dress up and put on makeup. I thought it was wonderful.
And maybe you could also say a little bit about the difference in its profile, the profile of Gilbert and Sullivan in England versus in the U.S. I mean, I think in the U.S., to whatever extent people think about it, they just assume, well, everybody in the United Kingdom is just a dyed-in-the-wool Gilbert and Sullivan. If not fanatic, they're imbued enough with it so that, you know, they wouldn't be clueless about it. They'd recognize a reference to most of the major works. Whereas in the United States, I do feel like there's a certain amount of segregation that's gone on. How fair an assumption is that about England?
Not terribly in this day and age, I'm afraid. What's happened is that if you take Doyle Cart Company as being maybe the epitome of the Gilbert and Sullivan genre in Britain, it really went out of business in about 1982. It sort of popped back in and out. 2003 was its last group of performances. And there is some sort of resurgence going on right now in 2013. But when I was growing up, I can't say that all my friends were roaming around whistling "I Am the Model of a Modern Major General," for example. So I would say perhaps not as much as you might think.
All right. I'm going to go to Bob Cummings here in just a second, but I'm realizing also that we've been discussing all this without playing any music whatsoever. That seems wrong somehow. So for those of you who can't even really sort of summon to mind an audio picture of Gilbert and Sullivan, we're not going to do one of the super familiar ones, but from HMS Pinafore, let's hear a little bit of "Never Mind the Why and Wherefore."
Never mind the why and wherefore, love can live or like some therefore, though his lordship station's mighty, though stupendous be his brain, though her tastes are mean and flighty, and her fortune poor and plain. Ring the merry bells of fortune, rend the air with warbling wild, pour the union on his lordship with a humble captain's child. For a humble captain's daughter,
for a gallant captain's daughter,
and a lord who rules the water,
and a tar who rules the water.
Let's hear with joy the little prince of the air above, for the union of a maiden with the men who was the
They'd all just have me play it all the way through, but then the show would be over after one song, so we can't do that. So Bob Cummings, there are some people – well, first of all, before we get to that, we should just sort of say a little bit about what these groups do. So the Connecticut Gilbert and Sullivan Society does what?
We devote our time and talent to the perpetuation of the greatest art form music has ever known. And don't take my word for it, but there's a Pulitzer Prize-winning book called The Greek Way by a Hadleim person named Edith Hamilton. She was president of Bryn Mawr College in Baltimore and for 26 years. She received a Pulitzer Prize for her book called The Greek Way, in which she compares Aristophanes and Gilbert as history's two greatest satirists.
Although one of the problems, of course, with satire that's located in a specific time is that it seems very located in a specific time.
Right.
That's even true, as Jerry would tell you, about Cole Porter. Some of Cole Porter's songs are just drenched with these references to things that were very much of the moment in 1934, but which mean absolutely nothing to me now. I mean, I know who Mrs. Astor is and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. there's a lot of things. And so how about that? How about sort of when you do it, does it just seem like an artifact, a beautiful artifact, an antique from that era, or is there a way to make it kind of connect to a contemporary audience?
It does connect with today. Mankind has his foibles, and Gilbert was pointing those out then, and if they see beneath the surface, you'll see that he's doing it right now.
We'd love to hear from you about this. We have some calls coming in already, 860-275-7266, particularly if you have a question, if you sort of kind of always wondered about all this, 860-275-7266. And so as long as we're talking about that, of course, one of the things that people, the companies occasionally try to do, there are I notice, Dick Vaughan, that you've got a poster there for the Mikado. So Sloco is doing the Mikado this year?
Yeah, actually in 2014, March 2014, we'll be putting it on and auditioning for it in the next couple of weeks.
All right, so start loosening up and practicing a wandering minstrel. We'll play a little from the Mikado in just a second here. But one thing that you can do and that people sometimes do, and I don't know whether you regard this as apostasy, but for example, in Coco's Executioner's Song, which is a song in which he sings about various people whose heads could profitably be lopped off with no great loss to mankind, some companies do insert the names of contemporary people. Actually, one London company a few years ago had Serena Williams in there, which seemed wrong on so many different levels. But you know, you can pop a lot of contemporary names in there if you want to. I mean, what's your feeling about that?
We've done it in the past and quite successfully. I think it draws the audience in a little bit more. It makes it a little more relevant to daily operations, what you see day to day, the wonderful people that rule us and so on and so forth that are incompetent, which is what Gilbert was trying to get at. So we try to pick that out in the little list. So I don't personally worry about it, but we may have an artistic director that might not think it was the best thing in the world, but I think it's a great idea.
I'll give you $15 if you can get my name into it. Mm-hmm. I have a Gilbertian way of rhyming McEnroe. It's to and forth and back and fro.
Okay.
To and forth and back and fro, pa-pa-pa-pa, McEnroe.
Yeah, but if you want to be in there, it's actually going to cost you a lifetime membership.
All right,
yeah.
I'll do it. I'll do anything for that kind of immortality. You know, maybe one way actually, before we get to that, we should play a little something from the Mikado, once again, to sort of freshen your mind up a little bit. And this is probably my favorite Gilbert and Sullivan song. Not that I know enough Gilbert and Sullivan to have any business having a favorite song, but A Wandering Minstrel I from the Mikado, I think sort of, I don't know, gets at three or four things that I really like about Gilbert and Sullivan. So let's hear a little of that, too.
A wandering minstrel, I, a thing of shreds and patches, of ballad songs and snatches, and dreamy lullaby. My catalogue is long, through every passion ranging, and to your humors changing, I tune my supple song, I tune my supple song. Are you in sentimental mood?
That's from the Mikado. You know, I think another thing we need to do that we haven't done yet is kind of set this stage a little bit more. So, John Dreslin, help people understand who these guys were, who these guys were, what kind of milieu were they functioning in? What were they trying to do? Who were Gilbert and Sullivan?
Well, Gilbert, they both had very successful careers outside of their collaboration that they did together. Gilbert was a very successful playwright, mainly of comedy. He was also wrote humorous pieces for periodicals at that time. He practically invented the art of directing, stage directing as we now know it, where one person would sort of give the whole idea of how the show should go, who should stand where and such. Now, Sullivan was also a very, very well-trained musician. He was one of the founders of the Royal Academy of Music. He had won scholarships to study abroad. He had done a lot of research, found, I think, turned up one of the missing scores of Schubert. He was one of the best-known at the time classical music figures in the English scene. As a matter of fact, he was eventually knighted, not for his work in the theater, but for his classical music work he had done. So they both were successful in their own fields, and they were brought together by a fellow by the name of Richard Doyle Carte, who was able to bring them together and get them to work together, and their talents melded together so well. That's what makes these works so so wonderful. I think they were both at the top of their game, and it's just magic when you bring them together.
You know, Jerry, maybe you could talk a little bit about where how they're understood within the pantheon of music too. And I think this is a complex question. For example, your very good friend Steve Metcalf, who likes virtually every kind of music that there is, and I hope I'm not talking out of school when I say this, has no relationship whatsoever to Gilbert and Sullivan. He just doesn't like it, can't relate to it, just doesn't, you know, there's very few kinds of music that Metcalf doesn't dig, but he just doesn't dig this stuff. And Sullivan is a really complicated figure musically. My sense is, and help me out with this, but my sense is there are some people who think that maybe if he hadn't frittered so much time away on these incredibly popular Gilbert and Sullivan musicals, he would have been Britain's Mozart, or at least the greatest British composer since Purcell.
Well, there are those who claim that he was the British Mozart.
How plausible a claim is that?
That's pretty plausible. I mean, he's not Mozart, but he's a great composer. One of the problems, to a certain extent for me, is that the music of Pinafore and Pirates and Mikado, which are the three most popular operas, as they called them. They didn't even call them operettas. They called them operas. Mm. They're the three most popular with the public. To me, they don't have anywhere near the best music that Mr. Sullivan wrote for these things. For me, you have to go to Yeoman of the Guard, Iolanthe, Retigor, Princess Ida, Patience. And it's interesting that, like many composer-lyricist pairs, Rodgers didn't get along all that well with Hammerstein. Lerner didn't get along all that well with Lowe. And Sullivan didn't get along all that well with Gilbert, because Gilbert wanted mostly simple type patterns, simple type melodies, everything kind of hummable. And Mr. Sullivan had greater artistic aspirations. He wanted to write operas, and he wanted to write oratorios. And of course, the irony is that when Sullivan actually was able to do this, after he started his collaboration with Gilbert, he went in and out of these other forms. He was nowhere near as successful as he was with Gilbert. Yet the tension was always there in Gilbert and Sullivan, between Sullivan wanting it more serious and Gilbert wanting it more popular.
And Sullivan is, I mean, there are these correspondences where Sullivan basically says, I can't do this anymore. I cannot write this stuff anymore.
He said, you know, he kept saying, I'm tired of rum-ta-dum-ta-dum-ta-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum. You know, how many times can you do that?
And he says, I'm constantly having to fade my music back, really, to make room for your syllables. And so you do have this guy. I mean, I'm sure we could think of some analogies, but a guy who has these incredibly serious aspirations, but who's so much more popular for this other stuff.
Well, Leonard Bernstein, for one.
Mm-hmm.
Leonard Bernstein did not want to be remembered as the composer of West Side Story, as he's mostly remembered. He wanted to be remembered as a composer of symphonies and sort of great classical works, which he's not.
Later in the show, we're going to play some of Jerry's picks for music from some of those operas that maybe illustrate Sullivan at his more high-minded aspirations. But before that, we're going to take a break. Before we take a break, I want to just grab at least one call. Our number, if you want to call in about this, 860-275-7266. Are you already under the spell of Gilbert and Sullivan? If so, what got you there? Was it Linda Ronstadt? Was it Kevin Kline? Was it something else? We'd love to hear. 860-275-7266. Or you're not, you don't get it, you have a question, that's even better. Here's Jim from Woodstock. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call, and hello, Mr. Dreslin. We have shared some Gilbert and Sullivan in the past, and one note is the last time you brought me onto your show, it was on the Beard Show, and I called in about being a lifetimer and that the last time I had cut off my beard was to sing Nanky Poo, and you said, oh, the Mikado. So I have done seven roles in Mikado. I mean, in G&S, and I love them. I first learned G&S at a summer camp.
And what is it you love about them?
Well, you know, all the things that you said. It's the silliness, but the music is so wonderful because I'm a musician of a lot of different kinds of music, and so the music is very, very rewarding. In many cases, not at all easy to sing. But then when you put what they called the topsy-turvy into things, which was the weird little plot twist that would start to explain things or confuse things, they fit together so beautifully. And I just love doing them.
All right, topsy-turvy, also the name of the great movie about the making of the Mikado. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll have more Gilbert and Sullivan. I don't know why I have trouble saying that. Gilbert and Sullivan.
Major General, I've information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quit the fight historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. I'm very well acquainted too with maths mathematical. I understand equations both the simple and quadratical. Above my Binomial Theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news. News. Ooh. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
When the nightwine howls in the chimney cows, and the bat in the moonlight flies, and inky clouds like funeral shrouds sail over the midnight skies. When the footpads quail at the night bird's wail, and the black dogs bay at the moon.
All right, that's from a little bit of Redigore, one of Jerry Marshall's examples of maybe Sullivan reaching a little bit more, writing a slightly more beautiful music. But before we even get back to Jerry on that, I wanted to just sort of talk around the table about this a little bit, because it does seem as though Gilbert and Sullivan, which is what we're talking about here today, our number if you want to chime in, which a lot of people seem to, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. They're either in this perfect sweet spot between high and low culture, or they're in this horrible sweet spot between high and low culture, sometimes defamed as middle brow. And it does seem as though you could sort of say the same thing about Rodgers and Hammerstein, but Rodgers and Hammerstein, were their goal was to take musical theater up from its commercial roots and, you know, give it, I think, maybe a little bit more of an artistic sheen and cachet, whereas with Gilbert and Sullivan, there's maybe a sense in which, particularly in Sullivan's case, he's dropping, as we were saying before, he's slumming a little bit. He's dropping down a little bit. He's leaving kind of high culture and composition to write this kind of stuff. But Bob Cummings, that's not the way you feel, because you feel like this is just the greatest stuff ever, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, going way back to 1872, that was before Trial by Jury, quite a few years, only 1 year after Thespis, which is being done about half a dozen versions now. Sullivan wrote a festival Te Deum dedicated to Queen Victoria, and of course it made a lot of his fellow composers jealous because he had all those connections with the Duke of Edinburgh and the Prince of Wales, who got together and wanted him to do something special for the Crystal Palace. And they came up with his festival Te Deum, and they allowed him 2,000 musicians with which to do that. And that meant the use of the organ in the Crystal Palace, and there were 26,000 listening to this premiere along with the Queen. They had at least 1,200 singers. But the main thing is he was an established composer, and my favorite work of all, including the Golden Legend, was his festival Te Deum in 1872. He edited all the scores for Novello and Chapel so that there was this operatic overtone with his best works. And those who love opera, like especially, well, those of us here, are laughing, and other people don't realize it because he's suggesting a similar situation in Grand Opera.
Well, and the clip that we played, Jerry, that you had chosen, it does sound a little bit more like Grand Opera than some of the others,
well,
right?
Also,
the
chorus that comes right before it, where the ancestors of Sir Rivin Murgatroyd, or he's hiding out as Robin Oakapple, come out of their full-length portraits in a great coup de théâtre, and sing to him in a very kind of spooky minor key way that Gilbert absolutely hated. He hated it. And he kept getting, you know, to Sullivan to try and change it. And that was one of their, periods where they simply didn't see eye to eye at all. And indeed, Redigor was not very successful commercially for the Gilbert and Sullivan canon, and Gilbert suggested later that perhaps they should have called it Kensington Gore, or Not So Good as the Mikado.
Well, you know, and that, you know, John Dresler, that brings up another question. We were talking before the show. You actually were kind enough to hand me a sheet of the, I believe, 13 extant.
14.
Well, there's 14, including Thespis, right?
Yes,
yeah. Mm-hmm. There's 13 light operas, 13 Gilbert and Sullivan works that anybody can do. And then there's this 14th Thespis, which was a bomb, really, in its day, and is sort of considered missing. But, you know, of this 13, how many of them really can you do for an audience that's going to want to hear it? I mean, there are, you know, as somebody said earlier, there's the three big ones, you know, that people tend to know. And are all 13 of them workable, usable things that you would not hesitate to stage? I'm going to ask Shloko about this also in just a second, but go ahead.
There's 11 that are pretty commonly done, and then there's the three that aren't, the three being Thespis, where the music was lost, that's the, except for two pieces. And the other two that you don't hear very much unless you go to these Gilbert Sullivan festivals like I do are Utopia Limited and The Grand Duke, which were the two last works of Gilbert and Sullivan. At that point, they really were feuding, and I think the works suffered as a result. When they were doing Utopia, they were barely speaking to each other. They'd basically be sending mailings to each other, and it lost. They used to make sure they'd refine their works and edit them and throw out numbers that didn't make it. Whereas in Utopia and Grand Duke, they're overlong. A lot of them. Musical pieces are just not of the quality that the earlier ones are. As you said, the three most popular are Pinafore, Pirates of Penzance, and Mikado. If you go to England, you can probably throw Iolanthe in that mix because that's very popular in England. The others take a little more delving into, I think, but the rewards are great if you'll take the time to listen to them. The music is of high quality. The plots are funny, for the most part, and so the only ones actually that I have never actually performed are Utopia Limited and Grand Duke. but all the others, including our reconstruction of Thespis that we did some years back. And so I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it does. Well, Dick Vaughan, does that sort of much, pretty much conform with your sense of things? I mean, I noticed that Sloco is doing the Mikado. Obviously, you want lots of people to audition and want to be in these shows. You want lots of people to show up when you do the shows. Does that mean you kind of have to steer towards those ones that people really love?
We have had a tendency to top load it, if you will, with those with the ones that we've just mentioned, Pinafore, Mikado, and Pirates. But the thing is, we've also had pretty reasonable success before with Iolanthe. I think it was one of our most successful shows that nobody had ever heard of. That was about 12 years ago, though, so we're in a slightly different time frame now. And in addition to that, Gondoliers has gone down quite well when we've done it, and we've done that twice. We've also been able to get some pretty good response to Human of the God.
Let's talk about also how the humor wears with modern audiences. So one of these that's not done that much. Actually, before I do that, let me go to Nathan first, and then we'll come back to this. But here's Nathan in West Hartford. We've got a bunch of people calling in, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Hi, Nathan.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just delighted you're doing this show. I've been a Gilbert and Sullivan fan since I was actually a very young child, and I was born in 1951, so that's a long time. And I was introduced to these because of children's records, 45 RPMs, if some of your listeners may remember those, of various arias from the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. I love the music, still love it, and when I was old enough to understand the lyrics, I thought they were ridiculous. And when I was able to see some of these in college and since then, I really liked the way that they set off some of the conventions in opera in a very ridiculous way. I think they're funny, not so much because of the topical references, although some of those are funny, but because they will kind of push the conventions in opera to the ludicrous. For example, the children switched at birth and how that's discovered. So in that way, say, Ruttigor is one of my favorite Gilbert and Sullivan operas.
You know, it's a perfect segue to what I wanted to talk about next anyway with these guys. And that is, by the way, lots of people calling in, 860-275-7266. In some ways, the humor of Gilbert and Sullivan is very modern. I mean, it's very Saturday Night Live in the sense that nothing's sacred. Everything's a legitimate target. If there are two sides in conflict, both of them are ridiculed and lampooned with equal mirth and fervor. On the other hand, my sense is that some of this stuff, and I notice we have some women calling right now, which is going to be very helpful to where I want to go next. Some of this stuff is borderline politically incorrect by today's standards. John is laughing over there. I mean, Princess Ida is sometimes listed as one of the operas that's not performed all that much because there's a lot of lampooning of what might be called feminism in it. There's also lampooning, for that matter, of evolution, which to Gilbert was, I don't know, an intellectual fad, or who knows what he thought it was. But
well, it was new.
It was new. And so you're laughing about that. I mean, is it sometimes a struggle to square, you know, Victorian senses of humor and stuff that Gilbert might have thought was mockable, because he basically thought everything was mockable, with some of our standards today? Oh. You were laughing. You have to answer the question.
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Well, I mean, you know, let's take Princess Ida. There's some mocking of feminist aspirations.
Oh, yeah,
in there.
There's a whole long trio lampooning the women in their college. The idea behind Princess Ida is that the women have decided that they can do fine without men. So Princess Ida has established this university for women only that's so extreme that she won't even allow chessmen into the university, and all the mail has to be delivered by women instead of men. And they have this wonderful trio where they list off the aspirations of what these women are going to accomplish. And then, as you also said, there's also another number where they sort of lampoon Darwin, where they point out that man is so lowly because he descended from apes, whereas I guess they figure that the women didn't descend from apes. As a matter of fact, there's a quote from Princess Ida at the Bronx Zoo outside of the monkey house saying that man is only a monkey shaved.
A Darwinian man is only a monkey shaved.
All right, that's great. Let me grab a call here from Corinna. Hi, Corinna.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind down there in Guilford?
I just wanted to, if you're really interested in doing the show today, because I'm in my 40s, I'm a 40-something person, and, you know, when I tell my contemporaries about Gilbert and Sullivan, they kind of look at me very strangely. we've been going to plays since I was about 3 or 4 years old. My parents both loved, absolutely adore Gilbert and Sullivan, basically from my mother's parents, knew every play, every word, and all that. So it's just like I said, I just think it's really neat that you're doing the show because no one I have ever talked to has ever really even heard of the plays or the two men. And I think the music and the comedy and, you know, the ability to have people laugh at themselves. So you were just talking about the feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how many women like the plays. But, you know, they basically mocked a lot of things. And it was, I don't know, the ability to laugh at ourselves, I guess, is human.
Yeah.
They did a very good job at that.
I mean, even in a play like Princess Ida, dim-witted men are mocked just as much as feminist women are. So,
more so,
probably, yeah. So thanks very much for that. Although, this brings up another question, which I – so Corinna, who says she's in her 40s, is also representing herself as kind of the youth vote here. And one of the questions that I have right now is anybody under 40 listening to this show right now – because my sense is, once again, I have a pretty young staff here of producers, and they were all, well, yeah, we don't really know anything about this. So maybe you guys can talk about this a little bit. I mean, Dick Vaughan, is it possible to – are you finding it relatively possible at Simsbury Light Opera to get young people interested in either performing in this material or going to see the performances?
As far as performing is concerned, the soloists' principals that come out tend to be younger, especially the sopranos. We get an incredible choice of ingenue sopranos when we try out. But as you get a little further down the road and you're trying to get tenors, that gets a little bit less. But the biggest challenge we have is the chorus and trying to get people under the age of 45 or so to actually perform on stage. That's a real – it's harsh for us. It's difficult to do. But we've just got feet on the ground, and that's about the only way that we can go.
One of the ways that younger people can sometimes discover this is by contemporized versions of it or versions performed by contemporary artists. Of course, when I say contemporary artists now, I'm talking about people my age. I'm not really sure if anybody in their 20s that I know of as a contemporary artist is doing Gilbert and Sullivan. But one rock star who has been a long time Gilbert and Sullivan fan is Todd Rundgren. And on one of his much earlier albums, this is from quite a ways back, he actually did something from Iolanthe, the Lord Chancellor's Nightmare Song. Let's go out to our break on a little bit of that.
Love, hopeless love, my ardent soul encumbers. Love, nightmare-like, lies heavy on my chest. And weaves itself into my midnight slumber. When you're lying awake with a dismal headache and reposes to boot by anxiety, I conceive you may use any language you choose to indulge in without impropriety. For your brain is on fire, the bedclothes conspire of usual slumber to plunder you. For Sir Counterpane goes and uncovers your toes and your shoes.
The very model of a modern major producer today was Patrick Scahill with Betsy Kaplan and me. The part of Bill Curry was played by Kevin Kline. On tomorrow's show, we're live from the study on Chapel Street in New Haven with the team behind Streetcar Named Desire. And now, back to Colin.
I love like big butts, and I cannot lie. All you other brothers can't deny. When a girl walks in with an itty-bitty waist and a round thing in your face, you get sprung. Wanna pull out your tuff, cause you notice that butt was stuffed deep in the jeans she's wearing. I'm hooked and I can't stop staring. Oh, baby, I wanna get witcher.
That, of course, is a Gilbert and Sullivanized version of Baby Got Back, the old-school hip-hop classic. And, you know, there are obviously lots of ways to modernize and play around with Gilbert and Sullivan. Although Bob Cummings, I feel as though I'm triggering a migraine and you just playing something like that. I mean, how do you feel? I mean, and there are other efforts to sort of make Gilbert and Sullivan kind of a little bit more contemporary. In Australia a few years ago, they did a steampunk Mikado. Last year or so, the prestigious Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis did, I think, Pinafore, where a composer actually kind of resyncopated some of the songs, made them a little bit more of a rock beat or a tango. How do you feel about all this monkeying around?
Well, I thought the choreography in the Andrew Cook was especially creative.
Yeah, this is that's the Guthrie version.
Yes.
Yeah.
And sexy. Mm. Every opportunity he had, he would suggest the act. But I'm
the act.
Flattered that these people like Gilbert and Sullivan enough to want to push their own diminishing of the art form onto it. I realize they're just having a good time. And the secret ingredient of all Gilbert and Sullivan is joy.
Mm. That's a great way to put it. Let me grab a call or two here. We've got Daphne in Larchmont. Hi, Daphne.
Hi, Daphne. Oh, hi, Colin.
No, you can call me Daphne. That's fine. I'm cool with that.
I could. We actually were in New Haven together at the same time.
All right.
I'm Pearson 78, and I did Yale Gilbert and Sullivan along with David Hyde Pierce, and I wondered if you came to any of our productions.
I did not, and I certainly missed out there, and I didn't know that David Hyde Pierce was doing Gilbert and Sullivan with you. So let me just ask you that. Okay, so this is the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really remember too much about Gilbert and Sullivan from my time at Yale, which was also in the 70s. But I don't, was it a pretty niche kind of thing? I mean, did everybody sort of get what you were doing?
I'm actually not sure. I was in the Gilbert and Sullivan Society all 4 years. We did productions, 8 productions. They were well attended. We did rewrite words. You know, I've got a little list, of course, was rewritten. But I think people just enjoyed it because it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And David was hilarious. David and I did HMS Pinafore together.
Mm-hmm.
And then he actually directed Princess Ida.
Wow.
Which I was in, yeah.
That's a very cool reminiscence. Thanks for sharing it with me. You know, one production of Gilbert and Sullivan that I think was done, you know, very respectfully, but with much more kind of pop-oriented performers was the famous Pirates of Penzance that included Kevin Kline and Linda Ronstadt and Rex Smith. And let's hear a little bit of that. This is Linda Ronstadt. I'm in a Linda Ronstadt mood right now because the poor thing has Parkinson's disease and she's not going to be able to sing again. And she was such a wonderful singer. So let's hear a little bit of Poor Wandering One.
Surely strayed. Take heart, grace, thy steps retrace, poor wandering one. Poor wandering one, if such poor love as mine can help thee find true peace of
So, to my ears, that just sounds fabulous, you know. But there were people at the time saying, well, she's not a true coloratura, she's not this, she's not that, that's a pop voice. I don't know. John Dreslin, how does it work for you?
I actually loved Linda Ronstadt's performance. I saw it live down in New York. I've seen the movie multiple times, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. It was respectfully done, which I appreciate. The one thing, though, that one point I do want to make is that in our society, anyway, we try very much to use the original orchestrations that Sullivan wrote. You have to realize that Sullivan wrote He wrote the operas on the orchestra score. He didn't write a piano version and then orchestrate it. He conceived it in an orchestral form, and his orchestrations are just so wonderful. Woodwind writing is terrific. Always when I hear a different type of accompaniment, that's what grates on me more than actually the singers or how it's staged.
So you didn't like the Todd Rundgren synthesizer version. That's what you're trying to tell me right now, John.
Yeah, I feel you lose about half the quality if you do away with the original Sullivan orchestrations, because they're absolutely so wonderful.
Also, one of the things that they did in that production, which I didn't appreciate, and I don't see why they do, and they do this with Gershwin revivals, they take songs from elsewhere and put them in. So they take the Pater Trio from Ruddigore, which is great in Ruddigore and doesn't really make much sense in Pirates of Penzance, but nevertheless, there it is. Just quickly, you were talking about, you know, updating or not. About six or so years ago at Trinity, we did a, quote, updated production of Princess Ida set in the 1950s, but we didn't change a word of it. And recently, last year, even though it's not quite Gilbert and Sullivan, it's Sullivan and somebody else and sounds just like Gilbert and Sullivan, we did a little production of Cox and Box, the one actor. And the three guys who were in it, originally, when I approached them about doing this, they really didn't want to do this. They thought it was really kind of silly. But after we did it, it turned out to be this great hit, both with them and with the audience.
See, I went to that. I thought it was Adam Sandberg and Justin Timberlake. I didn't realize what that show actually was. But, you know, Jerry, just while I've got you here for a second, it seems to me, as we're kind of running out of time here, that one of the oddities of all this is that in some ways this stuff seems very located in the Victorian era. In other ways, not to keep beating this horse, but there's something explicitly modern about it. There's something very modern about its saucy, almost Monty Python sense of humor. And musically, I mean, not for nothing did we play the parody, the Baby Got Back parody. It does have some kinship with rap. If you back to Python, if you think about Spamalot, one of our callers mentioned Spamalot. If you think about and Muriel from West Hartford is calling in to say A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which launched at Hartford Stage and is now going to Broadway. A lot of modern stuff, you know, some of it sort of deliberately retro, some of it not. It seems like there's more kinship, more modern contemporary kinship with this stuff, with the humor and the music, than a lot of people are inclined to think. And I'll just pass that back to
you. If you're anxious for to shine in the high aesthetic line as a man of culture rare, you must get up all the germs of the transcendental terms and plant them everywhere.
That's actually not from Gilbert and Sullivan. That's the way Jerry talks.
You must lie upon the daisies and discourse in novel phrases of your complicated state of mind. The meaning doesn't matter if it's only idle chatter of a transcendental kind. That's timeless.
Yeah.
That is timeless. Very witty, very funny. And terrific music as well. That's from Patience.
No, I thought that was by Eminem. all right, quick call from Peter, and then we're going to kind of run out of time here. Hi, Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
I think that the last riff that you guys did there is absolutely the truth. The thing about William Gilbert is you have to listen to the words. And sometimes it's the play between what the chorus is singing and what the soloists are singing. And other times, it's just Gilbert being wicked. In Trial by Jury, he describes the rich attorney's elderly, ugly daughter as she may very well pass for 43 in the dusk with the light behind her. I mean, you know, who thinks of this kind of stuff?
Exactly. You know what? We're going to have to wrap up there. We do want to thank everybody who joined us today. And once again, we want to plug both the Gilbert and Sullivan Society. They're at ctgns.org. And Simsbury Light Opera Company. Get ready to audition for the Mikado and then see it in 2014. Special thanks to our friend Gerald Moschel, a professor of music at Trinity College. We'll be back tomorrow live from New Haven. Join us at the Study on Chapel Street in New Haven.
I'm Kyone Wolf, the very model of a modern radio producer, but I only have 10 seconds for this last word. Well, technically, it's not just one word, but a collection of words strung into a sentence or expression.
Ow.
Gilbert and Sullivan should come with a warning.